Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our third and last lecture on Virginia Woolf. It's been a quite exciting 3 days, 2 days, and now we're going to have a thrilling third day. As you leave, you might notice the stones on the walls. Those are the original stones of the old reservoir that was knocked down and used to build this building. Well, this crypt, at least. Anyway, thank you for battling our elevator and the stairs to come. My name is Jay Barksdale. I'm a librarian upstairs, and I oversee the details of the Wertheim Study, which is a room set aside for scholars and writers who have intense need of our collections on a long-term basis. And Dr. Fernald is just such a person. I've been getting in the mood of the way of Virginia Woolf and started The Waves because it fit in my pocket, and I'm going to read one paragraph. "The roar of London," said Lewis, "is round us. Motor cars, vans, omnibuses pass and repass continuously. All are merged in one turning wheel of single sound. All separate sounds, wheels, bells, the cries of drunkards, of merrymakers, are churned into one sound, steel blue, circular, then a siren hoots. At that, shores slip away, chimneys flatten themselves, and the ships make for the open sea." Well, keep reading it, and it'll really mesh together. It's a wonderful book. No plot, but six extremely interesting characters. Dr. Fernald is Associate Professor of English at Fordham University, where she also teaches the first-year writing and composition programs at the Lincoln Center campus. She was educated at Wellesley, received her Ph.D. from Yale. She's the author of Virginia Woolf, Feminism and the Reader. She's published articles on Woolf, Lawrence, and modernism in general in feminist studies, modern fiction studies, as well as the award-winning ICLA volume. ICLA is International Cognitive Linguistics Association. In 2009, she organized by herself the 19th annual International Conference on Virginia Woolf, which focused on the theme of Woolf and the city. And as you know, she is currently at work on the Cambridge University Press edition of Mrs. Dalloway. Please welcome Dr. Anne Fernald.
Thank you all so much for coming. Can you hear me all right? Yeah? If I start to... Pardon? A little bit louder. Is that better? Okay. If I start to fade, let me know, because I don't intend to. Thank you so much for coming. I'm really honored to have the opportunity to speak here and really excited to be able to share with you some of what I've learned in my work preparing a textual edition of Virginia Woolf's 1925 novel, Mrs. Dalloway. I'd like to thank Fordham University for two faculty fellowships, one of which allowed me to travel to see archival material in London, Indiana, and California, and the second of which gave me a sabbatical last spring to work full-time on this project. I'd also like to thank the New York Public Library, the Berg Collection, and above all, the Wertheim Study, my home away from home, for providing me with a quiet space and a shelf on which to keep my books these past 6 months. At the Berg Collection, I want to thank librarian Anne Garner, whose help and interest in my project buoyed me during a long, otherwise rather solitary period of intense research. And I really want to thank Jay Barksdale for offering me that shelf, for making the room into a community, and for organizing this and many other events. For the past 4.5 years, and most intensively for the past year, I've been at work on a textual edition of Mrs. Dalloway for Cambridge University Press. It's part of a forthcoming edition of all of Woolf's novels. You can get editions of Mrs. Dalloway, some with learned and helpful footnotes and scholarly introductions from several different publishers. What distinguishes a textual edition from these editions is the focus on the publication history of the novel and the ambition to offer the most complete documentation of references and allusions to date. When it is done, the textual editions of Woolf's novels may not be the ones you curl up with at night, but they will be the ones you consult to do research on Virginia Woolf. My task as an editor, then, is threefold. I need to compile a list of all the variations among all the English language editions of Mrs. Dalloway published in Wolfe's lifetime. And what you see here is my notebook comparing the first American to the first British edition. I have many, many, many pages that look just like this. Secondly, I need to and I also need to offer commentary on the most significant variants between those editions. Secondly, I need to annotate the novel as fully as possible with regard to any and all historical, autobiographical, cultural, and literary allusions. And finally, I need to write an introduction that recounts the textual history of the novel from conception through publication. In all of this, I need to keep my own interpretive hobby horses in check and let the novel and all of the texts surrounding it speak for themselves. As you might imagine, some of this work has been pretty tedious, and some of it has been very exciting indeed. I have spent hours and hours poring over every line of the novel, checking and rechecking to see if a comma in the first British edition is also in the first American. I have worked in the British Library, the Special Collections Room at UCLA, Indiana University's Lilly Library, and the Berg Collection here at the New York Public Library, reading and studying pages that Wolfe wrote, typed, or hand-corrected in each place. In my talk today, I plan to skip over the tedium, though you can be the judge of that, and share with you some of the most interesting things that I have learned about Mrs. Dalloway in the process of preparing this edition. I've called my talk On Traffic Lights and Full Stops because I've learned in my scrutiny of this novel that from the way Clarissa Dalloway stands on the curb waiting to cross to the way Wolfe punctuates Peter Walsh's memories, no detail is so small as to be unworthy of our attention. What you're looking at here is a reproduction of the first page of the short story as it appeared in The Dial in July of 1923. Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself. So begins Virginia Woolf's 1925 novel about a day in the life of a London hostess, Clarissa Dalloway. Over the course of the day, she will buy flowers, take a nap, mend her party dress, and greet her guests at the door. As we follow her and her memories of her youth, we also follow the final day of Septimus Warren Smith, a shell-shocked World War I veteran, as he visits a new doctor and despairs of ever escaping the torment brought on by having witnessed the violent death of his friend, killed by a shell in Italy. Although they never meet, although divided by age, sex, and class, Wolfe brings Clarissa and Septimus together by having them think parallel thoughts, including most markedly in their shared love of a somewhat obscure song from Shakespeare's late play, Cymbeline. But Clarissa Dalloway, the character, predates her novel. Wolfe's first novel, The Voyage Out, published in 1912, includes minor characters called Richard and Clarissa Dalloway. And in 1920, Lytton Strachey singled out the satire of the Dalloways from that novel as one of its best features. Perhaps this praise from a friend whose opinion mattered greatly played a part in Wolfe's return to the character in the spring of 1922. On April 14th of that year, she wrote a letter to T.S. Eliot about a story that might suit the Dial. And her story, Mrs. Dalloway in Bond Street, was published there in July 1923. It seems probable that Mrs. Dalloway in Bond Street was the story to which she referred. Throughout the summer of 1922, Wolfe's diary records her progress on the story as the story grew into a cycle and, in October, into a novel. In this, Mrs. Dalloway is unique among her books. Not only did it come out of her short fiction, but she also continued to write short stories about the minor characters after the novel's publication. Mrs. Dalloway shares a tight connection with Wolfe's nonfiction writing as well. As early as June 1922, Wolfe linked Mrs. Dalloway to what would become The Common Reader, a collection of literary essays, so that I could, quote, vary the side of the pillow as fortune inclines. From this point forward, Wolfe records her satisfaction in switching from fiction to nonfiction as a way to keep her writing fresh, as well as a guard against criticism. She writes, "If they say you can't make us care a damn for any of your figures, I shall say, read my criticism then." This sense that the one book could protect her from criticism of the other, and the hope that both books taken together would secure her reputation as a writer, persists up through her plans for publishing them in quick succession, hoping that her American publisher, Harcourt Brace, would accede to her wishes that the essays come out before the novels. Because of this, quote, quick change theory, the common reader is a particularly rich source for allusions in Mrs. Dalloway. When Wolfe remarks that Septimus read Aeschylus translated, we can surmise what that phrase might signify more precisely alongside Wolfe's essay on not knowing Greek, where Wolfe quotes Aeschylus in Greek and comments that its meaning is just on the far side of language. Wolfe's lifelong intense study of classical Greek presents an ironic contrast with Septimus's lack of knowledge. In Wolfe's world, it was usually the men who knew Greek better than the women. But in Mrs. Dalloway, Wolfe explores the barriers of social class that keep an ambitious, smart young man from the knowledge that she so prized. The sense of what Septimus cannot grasp alters again upon a glimpse at Wolfe's Greek notebooks and translations, and yet again when in a letter she notes that she herself read Aeschylus in French, which is better than in English. Perhaps even more surprising, the common reader reminds us that one of Septimus's most notably insane thoughts, you may remember he thinks communication is health, communication is happiness, also appears in Wolfe's essay on Montaigne, where she writes, "It is not fame that he wants. It is not that men shall quote him in years to come. He is setting up no statue in the marketplace. He wishes only to communicate his soul. Communication is health. Communication is truth. Communication is happiness." Suddenly, viewed through the prism of the great essayist whom she admired, Wolfe asks us to listen to Septimus's obsessive thoughts as simultaneously sane and insane. For all that Wolfe's private writing tells us about how closely the composition of Mrs. Dalloway coexisted with that of the common reader, for all the clues it gives to what Wolfe was reading and thus what allusions may be buried in the novel, the letters and the diary offer other clues to the development of the plot. One such clue involves the evolution of the title character herself, from a figure of satire into someone for whom we feel sympathy, someone sufficiently complex to warrant standing at the center of a novel. One point of origin for Clarissa Dalloway is Wolfe's family friend, Catherine Kitty Max, née Lushington. She was born in 1868 and she died in 1924. Wolfe was closest to Kitty in the early 20th century, before she was Wolfe, before Wolfe's public writing career began. In 1903, when Wolfe was 23 and Kitty 35, Wolfe records a series of unsatisfactory visits from Kitty to her father. Leslie Stephen died the next year in 1904 of cancer, and Kitty was making a kind of series of Victorian-inspired sympathy calls to the ailing Leslie Stephen. And the young Virginia Wolfe writes that Kitty didn't volunteer more than a fishy white glove to me, and describes Kitty as, quote, "eternal, cool and fashionable, white from tip to toe, and has little aristocratic stories without much point," end quote. This is Kitty from about that time. Already we can hear the seeds of Clarissa Dalloway, and the reason why in 1908, while writing The Voyage Out, Wolfe admitted to her sister that Clarissa is, quote, "almost Kitty verbatim." Some of Wolfe's harsh satire on Kitty in the letters can be attributed to her audience. Wolfe was often describing Kitty to her confidant, Violet Dickinson, a suffragette and an early encourager of Wolfe's writerly aspirations. For Violet's ears, Violet was not a beautiful woman and very strong intellectual, and she was also about 6'2". And so quite a contrast in looks in a very lookist culture to the lovely Kitty Max. For Violet's ears, then, it made sense that Wolfe loudly criticized her more bourgeois associations. Still, Kitty was a person from girlhood, and on occasion Wolfe remembered why they had once been close. In 1903, she wrote to Violet, "Kitty dined here Friday, came in after the meat was done, quite unexpected, and stayed till past 11. Really, I shall have to revise my judgment. She is going back to her early ways again, and she is then charming." The question of how a character based in part on Kitty Max with dashes of Adeline Morrell came to be named Clarissa has a richly entangled set of literary and biographical sources. Wolfe's father, the critic and editor Sir Leslie Stephen, was a great admirer of Samuel Richardson's 1748 novel, Clarissa. And even if we are to believe Wolfe's claim that she never read the novel, which seems weird to me, but maybe possible, but she certainly explicitly says she never read it, she certainly read her father's essay on it. She knew another literary Clarissa as well. In Alexander Pope's The Rape of the Lock, it is Clarissa who provides the scissors with which Sir Plume cuts off Belinda's hair. Clarissa is also a name that Wolfe genuinely liked, proposing it as a potential name for the baby when Vanessa was pregnant with Quentin. Obviously, she didn't know it was going to be a boy. And again, with Angelica. Clarissa's highly elusive, hyper-feminine name puts her in an ironic relationship to her own fate. By the standards of her class, Clarissa Dalloway's marriage to a kindly, if dull, conservative member of Parliament is anything but disastrous. The disappointments are small in the public sense, and yet, through her name and the novel's title, Wolfe signals that Clarissa's dissatisfaction is just as great as that of Richardson's heroine, her unquestioning abetting of patriarchy rivaling that of Pope's. Clarissa Dalloway in The Voyage Out is not a very likable person, and the Clarissa Dalloway of Mrs. Dalloway in Bond Street is not much better. In the short story, Clarissa is not buying flowers, but gloves, perhaps a nod to that fishy white glove of Kitty's. Her concerns, too, are distinctly womanly. She wonders if Evelyn Whitbread at 52 is going through that, and worries that a tired-looking clerk might be experiencing, quote, that one day in the month when it's an agony to stand. The role of the war differs dramatically, too. On the one hand, her loss seems to be greater. She thinks about the death of dear Jack Stewart and quotes Shelley's Adonais to herself. From the contagion of the world's slow stain, he is secure and now can never mourn a heart grown cold, a head grown gray in vain. But, on the other hand, Clarissa's Shelleyan mourning risks Shelleyan narcissistic self-dramatization. Though we now may come to hear echoes of Shelley at the back of the published novel, these words from Adonais eventually get displaced by Shakespeare. In the novel, Clarissa's mourning indicates her participation in a public grief, while her grief in the short story remains disconnected from a larger social trauma. Thus, in the novel, when the car backfires outside the glove shop, the flower shop in the novel, it's the first moment in which Clarissa and Septimus respond identically to an outside stimulus. By contrast, in the story, the noise only shakes Clarissa into remembering the name of that lady who's shopping. The protagonist in the novel is a much fuller, more sympathetic character than the Clarissa that Wolfe first sketched in 1912 and returned to in 1922. One reason for that richer depiction may lie in the fact that in October of 1922, just as Wolfe was beginning to see that Mrs. Dalloway had branched into a book, Kitty Max died after a suspicious fall over the banisters in her home. Wolfe suspected suicide. Leopold Max's biographer said she fainted at the top of the stairs and fell, but she broke her back and died. Reflecting on Kitty's death, Wolfe recalled Kitty's fear of doctors and that before she died, she had asked her husband if she would ever walk again. Of Kitty upon her death, Wolfe remembers, quote, her white hair, pink cheeks, how she sat upright, her voice with its characteristic tones, her green-blue floor, which she painted with her own hands, her earrings, her gaiety, yet melancholy, her smartness. Excuse me. Her tears, which stayed on her cheek. I'm sorry. Not that I ever felt at my ease with her, but she was very charming, very humorous. And in the blue-green of description, we can hear the beginning of the woman whose dress makes her look like a mermaid, that Clarissa shares Kitty's coloring, that her gaiety was tempered by melancholy, and that, though upright and hard to feel at ease with, she was full of charm. While the earlier description of Kitty as eternal, cool, and fashionable, white from tip to toe, also describes Clarissa, in this 1922 account, we hear both good and bad qualities, and equally important, we hear Wolfe alternating between sympathy and distance. Clarissa's green dress, which she is mending when Peter Walsh visits and then later wears at the party, is described as a silver-green mermaid dress. And the mermaid imagery throughout Mrs. Dalloway helps lead us out of the trap of seeing the character as too closely identified with one old friend from Wolfe's youth. A mermaid, like a siren, is a desexualized seductress. And, like a siren, Clarissa reminds Peter Walsh of his frustrations and failures. Peter, like J. Alfred Prufrock, has heard the mermaids singing each to each. And like Prufrock, he knows that they do not sing to me. This small, buried allusion to Eliot is but one of many throughout the novel, and it speaks to the fact that of Wolfe composing the novel shortly after she had set the type, letter by letter, for her friend's 1922 masterpiece, The Wasteland, just before writing this book. But mermaids are not only allusions to Eliot, John Donne, whose song asks, "Teach me to hear mermaids singing," or to Homer. They also allude to real women whom Wolfe read about or knew. For example, among her very scant notes on the diary of Lady Anne Clifford from late 1923 or early 1924, which are upstairs on the third floor, Wolfe records only two things. Secondly, that it is a very silly book. Firstly, she copies out the phrase, "my sea water green satin gown and my damask embroidered with gold." I think that's incredible to read a whole biography of an aristocrat and the only phrase you copy out is a description of a dress that you're going to give to your heroine of your novel. In 1907, Wolfe impulsively gave, quote, "all the money I earned last month in one handful to Catherine Horner. I got her a nice old looking glass with lady dolphins, naked to the waist, clasping arms around it. She is something of a sea green mermaid herself. Half of her lives beneath a sliding tide." That last phrase, "half of her lives beneath a sliding tide," suggests something about the appeal of the mermaid for Wolfe, emphasizing how thoroughly the allure is based in mystery. Then Wolfe's friend, the often satirized Adeline Morell, about whom Wolfe's feelings were often mixed, reminded Wolfe of a mermaid. One happy day in 1917, and of the thousands of photographs of Adeline that I could have showed you, I made sure to show you a photograph of Adeline in 1917. One happy day in 1917, Wolfe went to see her and found herself, quote, "so much overcome by Adeline's beauty that I really felt as if I'd suddenly got into the sea and heard the mermaids fluting on their rocks." Finally, dolphins and mermaids are often linked, so it makes sense then that Clarissa, whose avatar is the mermaid, would have a crystal dolphin on her mantelpiece. When we recollect that dolphin was one of Wolfe's sister Vanessa Bell's nicknames, we only enrich the matter further. So yes, Wolfe drew on the snobbish, conventional, but also sympathetic Kitty Max in her depiction of Clarissa Dalloway. But in Clarissa's dress alone, we can hear echoes of T.S. Eliot, John Donne, Homer, Lady Anne Clifford, Catherine Horner, Lady Adeline Morell, and Wolfe's sister Vanessa Bell. What you're looking at here is from the Monk's House papers in Sussex. And I haven't seen this document in person, but I was looking through the archive guide, and it said, map of London in a Mrs. Dalloway notebook. And I thought, well, I have to have a copy of the map of London in a Mrs. Dalloway notebook. And I said, prepare yourself for disappointment. It's going to be a disappointing map. And of course, it's an incredibly disappointing map and an incredibly fascinating map that Wolfe, a Londoner from birth, would have needed at some point in thinking about Clarissa's walk to buy the flowers to map out for herself this tiny little zigzag of a sketch indicating the relationship between Green Park and Bond Street, which she must have known by heart since she was 6 years old, you know. But that's what it is. And if anyone can read what's written vertically there, I'd be very grateful. I've been poring over the map of London and this map and trying to figure out what Wolfe's handwriting is tough, what that could possibly say. When on that June day in 1923, Clarissa Dalloway ventures out of her home in Westminster to buy flowers, she stands in the midst of a London still making the transition from a Victorian city to a modern one. Double-decker buses shared the road with horse-drawn carriages. If anything, the streets of London may have been more confusing and congested than they are today. A 1920 government pamphlet notes the advantages of requiring passengers to mount buses at designated stops rather than allowing them to hail buses at any point along the route. Ah, what a good idea. One of our first sights of Clarissa is of her waiting to cross, waiting for Dirtnell's van to pass. And this is just the first of many instances in which Wolfe records her characters navigating the congested streets of London. In fact, at the time, traffic congestion was not only a matter of general concern among Londoners, but it also touched Wolfe's life directly. In April of 1924, her niece Angelica, who'd been born in 1918, so she's a very little girl, was hit by a car. I'm happy to say that Angelica made a full recovery. This is her a few years ago in London at the unveiling of the bust of Virginia Wolfe in Tavistock Square. She did make a full recovery, but the accident initially looked very grave. "She's not dead," Duncan said, Wolfe writes in her diary. "They both thought her dead, run over across the stomach. The surgeon had been sent for and was now on the train." When this happened, Wolfe was in the middle of drafting Mrs. Dalloway. And 2 months later, she gave Richard Dalloway the following thought. But it did make his blood boil to see little creatures of 5 or 6 crossing Piccadilly alone. The police ought to have stopped the traffic at once. He had no illusions about the London police. Indeed, he was collecting evidence of their malpractices. It's an odd little moment in Mrs. Dalloway. Ever working, ever looking at the city as something under his ken, Richard Dalloway's concern for children immediately becomes further evidence for police malpractice. I found this here in the main collection at the New York Public Library. In 1920, a New York City traffic commissioner traveled to London to learn about traffic control in London. How was London dealing with the flood of buses, of mass transit, of the tube? And he collected a series of pamphlets and photographs. There's a wonderful letter to him at in his hotel room at the Ritz in Paris, saying, "Dear Mr. Nixon, it was so lovely to meet you last week in London. Can you please find enclosed the specifications for the 3 major kinds of buses that we're purchasing for the City of London, and you know, type S1000 seats 14 on the ground floor and 16 up top." And so it's great. It's a great catalog. But this is Piccadilly Circus at 6:15 in the evening in September 1920. So I think that's actually pretty close to noon in June 1923. So, and you'll see that J'accuse is playing in the movie theater. It's kind of cool. So how serious was the problem of children crossing Piccadilly? As it turns out, electric traffic signals were just coming into common use in the 1920s, mainly in America. The first ones were changed by hand by a traffic officer. The first electric traffic signal did not appear in London until 1929, 4 years after the publication of Mrs. Dalloway. Thus, the stray observations on traffic form part of Wolfe's larger goal of depicting the texture of London life. But there is more to it than that. Richard's way of thinking about traffic builds on her characterization of him as a conservative member of parliament, but having Richard worry about traffic in just this way, just weeks worrying about children crossing the street just weeks after a serious scare in her family embeds the history, both urban and personal, into the texture of the novel. Richard focuses on the police, but his historical counterparts were equally focused on the possibility of creating a subway under Piccadilly. The first annual report of the London and Home Counties Traffic Advisory Committee for the year 1925, which you can request and read in the reading room for yourself, records both that the desire to solve the problem of congestion in Piccadilly was longstanding and the committee's failure to capitalize on an opportunity. Quote, "The demolition of Devonshire House and the proposed erection of a new building on its site appeared to afford a good opportunity for reconsideration of the scheme. The necessary financial arrangements could not be made, however," end quote. Devonshire House was completed in 1737 for William Cavendish, the third Duke of Devonshire. In the time of the fifth Duke and his wife Georgiana, it became a center for the Whig opposition to the Tory government of George III. Clarissa, dreaming of where she has worn dresses in the teens and 20s, remembers going to parties at Devonshire House. However, in 1924, between Woolf's completion of the novel and its publication, Devonshire House was demolished. So by the time Mrs. Dalloway was published, Clarissa's memory is already of a lost place. Woolf herself recorded the destruction in an undated entry in a notebook, which also contains corrections to Mrs. Dalloway. Other dated entries show that she wrote this sometime between January 24th and March 16th, 1925. That means that this was written in the space between her correcting the proofs and the novel coming out. Woolf wrote, "Coming back to London after some weeks' absence, I was shocked to see that a battered cottage had replaced the shabby gloom of Devonshire House. Anybody who pays a penny to sit on the top of an omnibus may now see into the very saloons where the lovely Duchess received Fox and Burke and Sheridan." What has come to interest me as much as these traces of London history is how close the diary and letters allow us to get to the mysteries of the creative process. We see Woolf transforming her experiences into fiction, giving her own thoughts plus the traits of a distant cousin to this or that character. Take, for example, Woolf's diary from June 8, 1920. In this one entry, she brings together madness, a bus ride, an old singing beggar woman, as characteristic of a London June. One of Vanessa's servants, Mary Wilson, had had a severe nervous breakdown, and Woolf begins the entry with an account of seeing her taken off to St. Pancras Infirmary. "The sight of her taken off was sinister, and all the servants were looking from all the windows. What horrid people they are. This made my drive to Waterloo on top of a bus very vivid. A bright night with a fresh breeze, an old beggar woman, blind, sat against a stone wall in Kingsway, holding a brown mongrel in her arms, and sang aloud. There was a recklessness about her, much in the spirit of London. How many Junes had she sat there in the heart of London?" Many of the elements, as I'm sure you can hear, of this site from 1920 appear in both her 1922 novel, Jacob's Room, and again in Mrs. Dalloway. There, both Peter and Rizzia pause over the arresting, wordless singing of a beggar woman whose eum fam so represents a song of love which has lasted a million years, love which prevails. And later, Peter Walsh remembers, quote, "Clarissa once going on top of an omnibus with him somewhere, all a quiver in those days, and such good company." At one point, Rizzia thinks back with alarm on how a pleasant bus excursion to Hampton Court ends in Septimus's proposal that they both commit suicide. Less direct, but just as significant, we can trace Clarissa's feeling of being glad that he had done it, and somehow very like him, to that sense of vividness that Woolf herself felt as she watched Mary Wilson driven off in an ambulance. Surely, neither Woolf nor any of her intimates can have failed to perceive the similarities between Mary's madness and Woolf's own. Despite all the insight these juxtapositions of diaries and letters to novel provide, as one critic has said, quote, "We might look long at the very world that Tolstoy saw. We should never detect the unwritten book he found there." The novelist's genius, her gift, is to put these observations of a vivid bus ride or a woman getting fired simply for being German into a novel so that they no longer feel like snippets from a diary but become essential elements of a story. And in fact, while writing Mrs. Dalloway, Woolf was also working out her theory of the modern novel. The most celebrated of Woolf's essays on the modern novel is the November 1923 essay, Mr. Bennett and Mrs. Brown. And I'm not going to talk about this, but I just wanted you to see one of the other treasures of the Berg collection is a typescript of the second short story that precedes Mrs. Dalloway, a short story called The Prime Minister, and that's the one in which Septimus appears with a mission to assassinate the Prime Minister. Less well known among Woolf's essays on modern fiction, but equally important, is her study more than a year earlier of Percy Lubbock's 1921 book, The Craft of Fiction. The quotation above, suggesting that we might reconstruct Tolstoy's world and still not be able to make War and Peace or Anna Karenina out of it, comes from Lubbock. This very intelligent and genial early effort to theorize the novel is another underappreciated source for some of Woolf's ideas of what novels can and should be. Lubbock was Woolf's contemporary, and while he may not be much remembered today, he was then an influential man of letters, friend to Henry James, Edith Wharton, and E.M. Forster, and the craft of fiction itself caused a violent disagreement between Woolf and Lytton Strachey. In a July 1922 essay in the TLS, Woolf wrote admiringly of Lubbock's efforts to identify types of novels, methods of storytelling, to see how, in the end, Henry James surmounts in The Ambassadors problems which baffled Richardson in Clarissa. Woolf wrote that sentence, in which she restates Lubbock's genealogy of the novel of interiority dozens of times, dozens of times. Multiple notebook entries contain drafts of her trying to get the relationship between Richardson's attempt and James's triumph just right. The intensity with which Woolf noted Lubbock's book whilst drafting Mrs. Dalloway is a clue, but what does it tell us? I think Lubbock is trying to unpack how writers create story, how they make fiction seem real. He argues that the novel has developed techniques of greater and greater sophistication, techniques that make the writer less and less obtrusive and the story more and more vivid. James is the culminating force behind this. For Lubbock, James's triumph in The Ambassadors is his ability to make a whole drama out of Strether's thought. And in sorting out and defining this culmination, Lubbock loops back to Richardson, who, through the epistolary novel, hit upon a way to make a drama out of immediate emotions that never could be suspenseful if told in retrospect. In the final sentence of chapter 11, Lubbock writes of the novels after Henry James, "There is indeed no further for it to go." With that, he throws down the gauntlet. And Woolf's essay commends Lubbock's wisdom for stopping at James and expresses an avid desire to learn what comes next. Mrs. Dalloway is a little less humble. It represents a new model for the novel of interiority, and as such, I think, with it, Woolf makes a bid for a place in line with Richardson and James. Woolf finished revising Mrs. Dalloway in the fall of 1924, and she and Leonard began to plan for a spring 1925 publication date. Mrs. Dalloway was the first of Woolf's novels to have simultaneous U.S. and English publication on May 14, 1925. So in January of 1925, she received three sets of proofs: an English set for the Hogarth Press, this set has since been lost, an American set to be sent to Harcourt in New York, and now in the archives of the Lilly Library, and that's, you're looking at one of the images that that the Lilly librarians were kind enough to let me show, and a personal set which she bound into a book and sent to her friend Jacques Ravarat, who was dying in France. This set is now at UCLA. Woolf bound the Ravarat proofs herself in Japanese printed block paper with a stylized ginkgo leaf motif. She pasted this paper on a thin cardboard, slightly sturdier than manila folder, and sewed the pages together with red thread. The paper itself, the block paper, is a pale tan. The leaves are olive brown with eye-shaped cutouts in them that are filled imperfectly and artistically with red eyes. Wolf put the paper on sideways to my eye, so the bulbous tops of the leaves point east, the stems west. There is a small rectangle of the same paper pasted on the front cover, with the leaves running the opposite direction. On this homemade label, Wolf wrote, "Mrs. Dalloway," in her usual purple ink. The title page is inscribed, "Jacques, with love, from Virginia, 6th Feb, 1925. As exciting as it is to revel in Wolf's love of the book as a beautiful object, there is much to learn from even the smallest changes she made at this, the very last moment to make changes. Take, for example, the changes on page 96, which is what you're looking at here, in the scene in which Peter remembers the night that Richard fell in love with Clarissa. Taken singly, the changes seem simple enough. A period becomes a semicolon. A capital letter thus now must be set in lowercase. Altogether, however, we see Wolf changing the character of Peter's memory, eliminating details about Clarissa herself, about the island, about the hen she startles, and focusing the prose on a single flowing memory of an achingly beautiful moment. A moment in which Peter saw Clarissa's beauty at its most intense and simultaneously recognized that she would never marry him. And then there is the single most significant change at the proof stage. It is a change so major that I cannot claim to have discovered it or even pretend for a moment to have noticed it first. The change is a single inserted typescript page in proofs. It's pretty hard to miss. If you see the proofs, you notice it. While every other change Wolf made to the proofs, and there are many, could fit in purple inked insertions on the proofs themselves, for one scene, she crossed out much of a page, cut two pages of typing paper to the size of the proofs, and typed a significant addition. This insertion is the scene in which Septimus commits suicide. Septimus's suicide is perhaps the single most important event in the novel. In some ways, it is the only event in the novel. And the fact that this scene is also the single scene to which Wolf made a substantive correction, one significant enough to entail inserting a new page, deserves emphasis. Wolf readers and scholars interested in the novel should want to know that Wolf was rethinking Septimus's suicide in the very final stages of revision. After all, we know from her diary that she struggled with writing the mad scenes in Regent's Park, and she wrote in 1928 that she had originally thought to have Clarissa kill herself. So beyond the novel's plot, which is evidence enough, we have powerful documentation both of her sense of the suicide's centrality and of her struggle to write in the voice of madness. In adding lines to Septimus's final moments, Wolf narrates his thought process, humanizing him and having him consider all the options available. Thus, at the very last possible moment, Wolf adds the following: getting up rather unsteadily, hopping indeed from foot to foot, he considered Mrs. Filmer's nice, clean bread knife with bread carved on the handle. Ah, but one mustn't spoil that. The gas fire? But it was too late now. Holmes was coming. Razors he might have got, but Rizzia, who always did that sort of thing, had packed them. In my estimation, this is a major change. Wolf found the process of making simultaneous corrections to proofs for British and American readers tedious in the extreme. In the weeks in which she worked on this project, she also introduced many differences between versions of the novel, which persist to this day. There are just short of 300 differences between the first British edition of Mrs. Dalloway and the first American edition. This number cannot be hard and fast, but the changes can be divided into six categories. About a third of them involve removing a comma from the first American edition that appears in the first British edition. That's about 95 of them. Another 35 changes involve a similar demotion of punctuation. Then there are about 45 where the punctuation is made stronger in the first American edition. A handful of changes reflect a difference between American and British practices of punctuating direct discourse. Fully a third of the changes fit none of these categories. Other changes include changed or canceled words, phrases where multiple changes occur at once. among the most significant and most seldom analyzed distinctions between the British and American editions of Mrs. Dalloway regards the section breaks, those single blank lines that divide the novel. As the first British edition, and this is G. Patton Wright's observation, provides 11 divisions for 12 sections, whereas the first American edition shows only 7 divisions for 8 sections. The American proofs clearly show markings for 10 sections, but 2 of those fall on the bottom of the page in the first Harcourt edition, and Harcourt didn't do anything to show you that there was a new section there. Thus, American readers in 1925 could only perceive 8 sections, whereas their counterparts in Britain had the full complement of 12. The fact of 12 sections in itself seems a lovely, significant number for a novel that, in draft, was long called The Hours, especially as Section 9 begins with the phrase, "It was precisely 12 o'clock," on page 142, just about halfway through the 293-page book. But that resonant phrase does not mark a section break in the American edition. Furthermore, in Britain, but not in the United States, there's a section break on page 281, separating the scene in which Clarissa retires from the party to contemplate Septimus's death from the brief final scene in which Peter and Sally wait in the hopes of a private word with her. I chose this photograph of Wolfe because I wanted to show you a less familiar one, and also because it was taken by Adeline Morrell in June of 1923. So it's Wolfe in the month in which her novel is set. And then here, my last photograph is Wolfe in June of 1924, a year later, with a very famous close friend of hers. Several other significant, it looks like a really fun day, doesn't it? Several other significant changes at the very end of the novel deserve mention here. Most notably, just before that final section break, Clarissa thinks about Septimus. Clarissa thinks she felt somehow very like him, the young man who had killed himself. She felt glad that he had done it, thrown it away while they went on living. The clock was striking. The leaden circles dissolved in the air. When Wolfe got the uncorrected proofs from the printer, after that final sentence, "the leaden circles dissolved in the air," was an additional sentence. He made her feel the beauty, the fun. Wolfe deleted this sentence from the British edition. She amended it in the American one. So American readers to this day read, "he made her feel the beauty, made her feel the fun," while British readers do not. Of all the differences between editions on either side of the Atlantic, this has caused the most trouble. Critics have built arguments around this line, apparently unaware that the line does not appear in British editions. This has created some confusion and later derision among British Wolfians. Speculation as to why the change exists is difficult, and as I said at the very beginning of my talk, thankfully my task for Cambridge is not interpretive, but more strictly textual. Nonetheless, it's hard not to want to speculate, especially in a place like this. Unfortunately, my speculations have yielded little fruit. It's tempting to guess that Wolfe inserted this sentence, which pushes us to interpret Septimus as a scapegoat, into the American readers because she didn't respect American readers as much, right? She kind of reads Septimus's death for us. But I don't think that quite works because the sentence appears in the proofs. Unless one of you has a really persuasive argument for the difference, I'm inclined to see it as a particularly interesting example of how, in the tedium of correcting 3 sets of proofs, Wolfe occasionally made a mistake. Mistakes, of course, are in the eye of the beholder. Wolfe erred in the first edition, misidentifying the Bond Street Gentlemen's Club with the bow window as Brooks when it was really White's. And I think we can be glad that she's not too kind of careful or interested in which of Bond Street Gentlemen's Club has a bow window. Who cares? And young Elizabeth Dalloway's party dress is called pink 3 times, but once it's referred to as red. Is that a mistake? Or isn't it possible that Sally Seton, who herself wore red as a girl, would perceive pink as red? For it is through her eyes that the dress is red. As Percy Lubbock said, the reader of a novel, by which I mean the critical reader, is himself a novelist. He is the maker of a book, which may or may not please his taste when finished, but a book for which he must take his own share of the responsibility. And with that, I conclude my remarks. Thank you so much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them. Thank you. Yes. I don't know. I think everything I've read says white. There are two gentlemen's clubs that are close to each other on Bond Street, so I think it's Bond. But I'm no more a connoisseur of gentlemen's clubs in London than Wolf was, so I will be right in my addition, but it's not here in my head. Yes. She did it. It was for simultaneous publication. That was a very strong desire, and she corrected them simultaneously over in early January 1925, while she had the flu. And the Roveret proofs, the proofs seem to have traveled with her to Monk's house. And I can't keep straight in my head, and I'll maybe someday I'll ask you for help with this, Eric. You know, because some people can say, "Oh, clearly she did pages 1 to 70 in a stint, and clearly then the next pages happen." So, it's some of these things aren't clear to me. It's clear that it's simultaneous. There are a couple things that are clear: the Roveret proofs, so-called Roveret proofs, which were her personal proofs, she didn't make any corrections on them at all for the first 75 pages, and clearly knew that these are just to keep, and I'm going to send them to Jacques because he's dying, and I don't need to mark them. And then starting on page 75, some changes start showing up, and the typed page is in the Roveret proofs, and some of the changes that she adds the Roveret proofs are different from either the British or the American edition. And so I think it really, everything I can see really suggests that she was doing this all at once, that some days she'd work on the British and then transfer corrections to the American. Some days she'd work on the British and transfer the corrections to the Roveret, thinking it was the American. You know, so it's kind of a mess, and I haven't had good luck figuring it out better than that. Does that help?
Well, obviously no.
That's fantastic, Eric. Thank you. That's really fun. Right. That's great. Yeah, I like that.
It sounds to me like, I mean, I'm a medievalist. I know nothing about this
stuff. But you know textual criticism. Yeah.
I mean, it must happen all the time.
Well, I mean, one can only think. I mean, I know how tedious it is for me to sit and compare and, you know, read phrase by phrase and keep reminding yourself, and you start reading the novel. And you think, no, I'm not supposed to be reading the novel. I'm supposed to be saying, you know, Mrs. Dalloway said, comma, Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the... And you have to read so slowly. And, you know, I went through the first British and first American, I think, 3 times separately, and then collated what I'd done just to see if I could be sure that I could have the most accurate list possible. And so... if that's tedious for me, I can only imagine if you're a novelist and not a scholar and you just want your novel to come out, to think about, you know, do I care about this comma, or do I care about how we punctuate free and direct discourse? Or, you know, I mean, there's some moments, there are 2 passages in Mrs. Dalloway where it's indirect discourse in the United States and direct discourse in England. And just, you know, just it's really interesting. But, yes. Absolutely, but the proofs, the publication of the, she corrected the proofs in January, so she received 3 sets of proofs from the same Edinburgh printer, and then she sent them to Harcourt in January, and the novel comes out in May, in both the United States and Britain. So that's where the time lapse happened, right, is the setting up for the publication, because the proofs were all created in Britain. Does that help? Right. Well, she was correcting the proofs. She had the proofs all together at the same time. So that wasn't it wouldn't have been an issue of memory with correcting the proofs, because the issue with correcting the proofs would be the tedium of saying in line 5 on page 97, I want that word rose to be flower. And now I've got to change it line 5 on page 97 to other places. And it's really boring. No. What's really interesting, Helen Wusau's argument about the manuscript of the hours, and I'm not doing a genetic text which would, you know, collect and collate all the drafts and versions, but Helen, and I have looked at the manuscript of the hours in the British Library, and Helen Wusau has done a really lovely transcription of those manuscript notebooks, and I've looked at the manuscript notebooks of the Mrs. Dalloway upstairs. And Wusau's argument, which I'm inclined to accept, is that what's striking about the mad scene in Regent's Park, which is the one scene Wolfe describes as struggling with, is how uncorrected it is. That is a place where there are very few corrections. So in contrast to the suicide where she's revising it at the very last moment, she's writing that mad, she wants to be done. She does, you know, she knows what she wants to write and she wants to be done. And she fusses over seeing Peter's memory of the night that Clarissa met Richard. And she fusses over every time Aunt Helena shows up. She fusses over what to call Great Aunt Helena, which is not a major part of the novel. Although one of the interesting things I've learned just recently is that Kitty Max Lustington was apparently an incredibly gifted amateur musician. And her music teacher was a famous composer of the time with the surname Parry, P-A-R-R-Y. And so Wolfe gave Clarissa Dalloway the maiden name of Kitty Max's music teacher. I don't know how to write that in a footnote elegantly. That's going to be really complicated. But it seems interesting, right, that would persist, that's a little piece of trivia for you. They don't just say okay. I mean, there are. Would that they did. I've sent them sample pages. Susan Sellers, who's at Cambridge College, Cambridge University, and St. Andrews, and Jane Goldman, who's at Glasgow. Thank you. Are the general editors of this edition of Wolfe's novels. And so they have a style sheet that they send out, and I've sent them sample textual notes and sample end notes, and they edit it, and then I bat back and say no. And so we have a back and forth. They're trying to make it consistent across the edition, but their goal in selecting editors for these novels was to select editors, scholars whose work on Wolfe they admired, rather than selecting textual critics who might do a good job with Wolfe. And so we've been learning textual criticism along the way, but bringing our interest in Wolfe to bear. And I hope that turns out to have been a good theory. It's a risk. And the textual critics may not like it. But we're doing it's not a genetic text, it's not a postmodern text, it's a Cambridge University document. I mean, it's meant to be a very solid, scholarly, reliable, not very polemical, not polemical at all, edition of Mrs. Dalloway. And then, you know, other things will emerge. I'm sure I'll have articles to write about it that'll be more argumentative after this is done. Yes. It's not in the public domain yet because copyright is, what is it, for a writer of Wolf's age, it would be, because some of Wolf is out of copyright now. It's 75 years after publication, something like that, so the voyage out is. But you obtain permission for quotation of Wolf through the Society of Authors. So they own the rights to her copyright at this point. Yeah, Elizabeth. No. What it'll be is, if you're familiar with the Cambridge edition of D.H. Lawrence, it'll look kind of like that. And what I think very wisely the editors at Cambridge have decided is to take the first British editions of all of Wolfe's novels as their copy text. And so what you'll see is a page. Page 4 of Mrs. Dalloway will be identical down to the line breaks to page 4 of the first British edition, but it'll be a nice clean page with wide margins, and then at the bottom will be kind of code that'll say there are variants in the following lines, there are significant textual variants in one of those three lines, and there are footnotes to the following lines. So footnotes would be something like a footnote to Devonshire House. Right, so any kind of, and those footnotes are, again, not interpretive. I won't say as much about Devonshire House as maybe I did here, but I will say something of the history of it and note its destruction and note that there's manuscript, the unpublished manuscript material that comments on its destruction. You know, those things are significant. A reading of the significance of that doesn't belong in the footnotes. And so that'll be, so there'll be a version of Mrs. Dalloway that'll look exactly like, I hope, with, if I don't make any mistakes, the first British edition of Mrs. Dalloway, and then appendices listing all the differences, all 300-plus differences, a second appendix that has commentary on those differences that warrant commentary, like he made her feel the beauty, made her feel the fun, whereas, you know, I'll make one comment about there are a lot of commas here. But and every time there's a comma that changes, I'm like, say, oh, you know, here's the news about this comma. And then footnotes. And then a long introduction that'll be, you know, that'll be the history of the publication of the novel. That'll be some of the kinds of stuff I talked about here today.
I'm a little bit out of my element, but I don't, did you say anything about that to deal with editors?
No, because that was the beauty of Virginia Woolf's setup, is she and Leonard had their own publishing house. And that's why they did it, is they started the Hogarth Press so she wouldn't have to deal with editors, because her first three novels were published by her half-brother's publishing house. And she had a very difficult relationship with her half-brother who had molested her. It's not a great situation when you've got a molesting half-brother publishing your work and saying, can you change this thing? You know. So it's better to get out from under the thumb of that kind of patriarchal family drama and just say, my husband and I are going to do my work myself. So she didn't ever have to have anyone... And no one was telling her, make it shorter, or I don't understand it. And by the time of Mrs. Dalloway, Mrs. Dalloway is really the beginning of the peak of Wolfe's career. So by the time Mrs. Dalloway is coming out, Wolfe is already significantly famous that Donald Brace is really, really excited to publish it. And Harcourt Brace is just grateful that the Wolfes are willing to continue to work with them. And Harcourt Brace to this day, I mean, whatever it's called now, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, still publishes the Wolf backlist. There are 55 letters up in the Berg collection from between Leonard Wolf and Donald Brace. And they're wonderful, and there's nothing in them other than just, dear Mr. Wolf, I understand that Mrs. Wolf is finishing a novel. You know, can you tell me when it's coming? And, you know, the letters on Marconigram saying, dear Mr. Wolf, you know, I'm so excited to tell you that the Reader's Guild is making Flush an alternate selection for, you know. And so, you know, dear Mr. Wolf, it's too bad that the Depression has hit. Flush didn't do as well as we thought it would, you know. So it's wonderful. It's wonderful stuff, but no. Yes. Thank you. Yes. First American, the actual book. And I've also looked at the American proofs and the personal proofs, the Ravarat proofs.
Oh, because I was wondering, is it possible that some of the differences
could be attributed to public publishers and editors? Yes, but, right, on the Harcourt proofs, there are maybe two pencil marks that come from neither Leonard nor Virginia, that must come from Harcourt. And there, so it's so lightly edited, and the differences, you could, I mean, it makes my ears bleed to try and do this, but you can compare the British edition against the American proofs and the first American edition and reconstruct a lot of what must have been in the British proofs. Now, you never could know whether those changes on the British proof were from an editor or not. But everything we know about the Wolff's publishing process suggests a very light editorial hand and minimal errors. There are very few errors in the proofs, just a couple. The lore that I've heard, and I haven't seen this written down, so I repeat this to you as just gossip, is that the Wolff, Leonard and Virginia, who were, Leonard in particular, was very cheap. Tight, used proofs as loo paper. No. So I leave you with that. Yes. I think the reason is maybe even, I think that's right. I think the reason is maybe even more directly familial, that when you're, yes, when you've been molested and you have an oppressively patriarchal father who loves a novel about an oppressively patriarchal family in which a daughter is raped and dies, it might not seem to you like I want to read those 1,500 pages. You know, I mean, you might think, that's maybe not my book. No, but Wolff read everything. I mean, one of the challenges for me in figuring out how to footnote this is that everything that was published before 1925 in some ways is fair game for a footnote. So if you hear something, you think, well, could that be Aeschylus? Could that be Sappho? Could that be? And so what I've been doing is poring over the essays that she wrote while she was writing Mrs. Dalloway with the thought that the most likely source of an allusion is the thing that she's reading while she's writing it. And other things, if they're more direct, I'm more confident in them. But I'm not just trying to pull out of the air every allusion to the history of English literature and say, you know, oh, every time there's a Nightingale, clearly it's Keats and everyone else who's ever mentioned Nightingales. But actually, you know, Wolff wrote an essay on Keats that week. You know, and so one of the things that I did when I was working in London was Helen Woosa transcribed the novel, but she didn't transcribe the essays. And so she just says in her transcription, two pages of an essay on Keats. And I transcribe those two pages for myself so that as I look at the footnotes, I can say, oh, yeah. So you just keep trying to hear the echoes, you know, and I'm trying to hear the echoes in a responsible way rather than just saying, rubies, that could be the Arabian Nights. It could be, you know, the what is a valuable woman? It could be the Bible. It could be, you know, no. I mean, at a certain point you have to stop. I think that's all we have time for. Thank you so much for coming.